Good evening and welcome to the 20 Lessons You Need to Learn to Be an Informed Jew podcast. Tonight we are continuing. We're going to be doing part two of the entire Jewish history in 2 hours. So this is the second hour of Jewish history. It will take us all the way to the Six-Day War to 1967. Where we left off, we have the Jews of Jerusalem, of Judea, revolting against the Roman Empire. The last line we said was the cauldron was beginning to boil and soon it would erupt. We're in the year 66 CE. To go up against the might of the Roman Empire would be nothing short of suicidal. But after a long series of clashes in which small groups of Jews offered resistance to the Romans, they would respond with severe countermeasures. In 66 CE, that was the beginning of the Jewish War. There were some astonishing successes that the Jewish armies found, but such insults to its might Rome could not abide. Now, interestingly, at the time, the sages and the rabbis, they advised reconciliation with the Romans. They realized that Rome would retaliate with even greater force, and of course the entire country, the Jewish people, would be destroyed and decimated. The Sadducees, that upper class priestly group of the Jewish people, they were already pro-Rome. And now you had the Pharisees. They held modern views, moderate views, and if those two groups are the only groups, then wisdom might have prevailed and the history may have looked different, but the zealot extremists would have none of it. In 67 CE, in response to the revolt of the Jews, Rome sends out the empire's most experienced commander, Vespasian. This is a hit with a massive force, nearly 50,000 Roman soldiers. And while the Romans are besieging the city on the outside, the Jews are waging a civil war on the inside. As I explained earlier, you have the Sicarii and the Zealots. They have control of the Temple Mount. And the unlikely alliance of the Sadducees and the Pharisees, the moderate forces which rule the rest of the city, we have this terrible civil war going on. The Zealots, they destroyed the great storehouse of food so that people would have no choice but to fight or starve to death. And as the food storehouses were destroyed, famine breaks out in the city. Desperate people try to sneak out the walls. And as they try to sneak out the walls of Jerusalem, anyone that is caught by the Romans is put to death through crucifixion. And the historical accounts at the time describe thousands of crucified Jews surrounding the walls of Jerusalem. The leader of the Pharisees, the head of the Sanhedrin, the supreme Jewish court, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he sees that it's not much longer for Jerusalem. But the zealots do not allow anybody out, do not allow any of their fellow Jews out. They have control over the walls. In an ingenious plan, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he has himself put in a casket, and he's taken to Vespasian. He is able to find an audience with Vespasian, the general at that time in Jerusalem. And because of this amazing story, Vespasian grants him whatever he requests. And he asks for three things. But the most important request of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is, give me the city of Yavne and its sages. In other words, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai knew what was going to come. And what he really wanted was to save the Torah, save the Jewish law, even as Jerusalem would be destroyed. Vespasian at that point becomes the Roman emperor. He has to return to Rome. His son Titus takes over to finish the job of famously of Titus's arch currently in Rome. Titus attacks in the year 70, battering the city with his catapults. It takes him 2 months of intense fighting before he's able to breach the outer city walls and reach the Temple Mount. The day that he breaches these walls is the 17th of the Hebrew month of Tammuz. It's a fast day till this very day. Other terrible things have happened on the 17th of Tammuz as well. Now, Titus, he orders the second temple razed to the ground. And when is it razed? On the 9th of Ab, the very same day on which the first temple was destroyed. And what we end up having is the center of Jewish worship, the symbol of Judaism's special connection to God, was now gone. But Judaism, thanks to the foresight of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, with all its unique value system, was alive and well. Because now you had a center of Torah learning at Yavne, just as was promised to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai by Vespasian. And it was here that the rabbis, they put together the legal and spiritual infrastructure which would allow the Jewish people to survive without many of the institutions that surrounded the temple, that revolved around the temple, which were the backbone of Judaism. It was here that the rabbis institutionalized public prayer as a replacement for the temple service, and they made the synagogue the center of Jewish communal life. They made Torah learning the center of Jewish communal life. After the destruction of the temple, the level of hostility and mistreatment of the Jews, it escalated throughout the Roman Empire, and it became unbearable. And in response, the Jews did revolt several times more. Each time, thousands of their number were killed. Interestingly, just to keep in mind, there were at this point a considerable number of Jews living outside of Israel. Historians estimate that there were about 5 to 7 million Jews living in the Roman Empire, and at least 60% of that number were outside the line of Israel. So, for instance, you had Alexandria in Egypt, which was one of the most cosmopolitan cities of the era. It had a Jewish population of about 250,000 Jews, boasting the largest synagogue in the world. Now we're going to go to 117 CE, so 47 years after the destruction of the temple. 47 years after the destruction of the temple, and Hadrian, he took the reins of power, and at first he inaugurated an atmosphere of tolerance. He even spoke of allowing the Jews to rebuild the temple, although the Hellenists were virulently opposed to this idea. But then in 132 CE, a man by the name of Bar Kosiba, or known as Bar Kokhba, he organized a large guerrilla army and succeeded in actually throwing the Romans out of Jerusalem and Israel and establishing, although for a very brief period, an independent Jewish state in Israel. In fact, the Talmud tells us that that kingdom, this independent kingdom, lasted for 2.5 years. Rome obviously could not let this be. It had to be crushed, and those responsible had to be punished brutally and totally. Bar Kokhba made his final stand in the city of Beitar, which is to the southwest of Jerusalem. The city fell on the saddest day in the Jewish calendar, again the 9th of Av in the year 135, the 9th of Av, the same date as both the destruction of the first and second temple. As part of his policy of erasing the Jewish presence from Israel, Hadrian leveled Jerusalem and on top of it built the pagan city he had planned, which he named Aelia Capitolina, Aelia, which was in honor of his own name, which was, I believe, his middle name or his second name, and Capitolina, which was in honor of the god Jupiter, whose temple was actually located in Rome, which meant for the first time since King David made Jerusalem Israel's capital 1,000 years earlier, Jerusalem was empty of Jews. It's ironic to think about this because that meant that the first city in history to be made intentionally Judenrein, Jew-free, was our very own Jerusalem. To further squelch any Jewish nationalistic feeling, Hadrian renamed the land as Philistina or Philistia or Palestine after the Philistines, who were an extinct people who once occupied the Mediterranean coastal area and who were some of the most bitter enemies of the Jewish people as described in the Bible, as described in the Torah. With so much persecution and unrest, with the Jewish people fleeing the land of Israel, the rabbis knew that they would not be able to keep a central seat of rabbinic authority alive for very long. And a man was to emerge, make his mark, the son of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel II, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, or in English, Rabbi Judah the Prince. In a time of chaos, the rabbis decided that they needed to do the unprecedented. They had to write down the oral Torah, the oral law, again at Mount Sinai, a written law, and an oral law that would explain the written law was transmitted. The oral law was continued to be transmitted, never being publicly written down. Hadrian dies in 139 CE, and with his death came a bit of an improvement in the treatment of the Jewish community in Israel. And it's at this point in time when Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, he befriends the Roman emperors who succeed Hadrian, and it's at this time, between 170 and 200 CE, that the Mishnah, the first writing down, public writing down of the Oral Torah, was born. He realized that things would not get any better anytime soon, so Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, made sure he put in much work. Although much work was already done by previous generations, this was still a mammoth undertaking. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi undertook this monumental task of editing, explaining, organizing, bringing together all of the lessons and all of the teachings that had previously been transmitted orally, a vast amount of material Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, brought together, edited it, explained it, organized it, and the end result of this massive undertaking was a definitive written version of the entire Oral Torah called the Mishnah. The word Mishnah means repetition because it was studied by repeating or learning. And what the Mishnah was a very basic writing down of the Oral Torah. No sources, no reconciliation with contradictory statements, no explanations, but it was an unprecedented act that meant the salvation, really, of the heart and soul of the Jewish people. Copies of the Mishnah were made and widely disseminated so that the Oral Torah might never be forgotten in Israel. As I said, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi finished the Mishnah around 200 CE in the town of Tzipori in the Galilee. Not long after the death of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the period known, the scholars known as the Tanaim, the word Tana is derived from the Aramaic word to teach, and the scholars that were called Tanaim, they covered a period of 200 years from 10 BC to 200 CE, beginning with Rabbi Shimon and ending with Rabbi, the son of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbi Yossi. During the centuries following the completion of the Mishnah, the chain of transmission of the Oral Torah, of the Oral Law, was further weakened because many different factors, a lot of upheaval. And although the basics were written down, everything that wasn't written down was at the risk of being forgotten, was at the risk of that transmission being weakened. Now we have to remember, by this point in time, about the year 500, a significant portion of the Jewish population was living in Babylonia, outside of the bounds of the Roman Empire, which we will talk about soon. The rabbis there, they put together their discussions. They put together their explanations of the Mishnah, the sourcing of the teachings of the Mishnah, the reconciliation of contradictory statements found elsewhere and within the Mishnah, and a whole other group of lessons and teachings. And this became, the end product was called the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. It's interesting to note that even before this process happened in Babylonia, in the land of Israel, a similar thing was going on and resulted in the Talmud Yerushalmi or the Jerusalem Talmud, but the Babylonian Talmud is authoritative till this very day. The text of the Gemara or the Talmud quotes the rabbis who live from 200 to 500 CE. They're called the Amoraim. These scholars are called the Amoraim, the explainers or the interpreters. Just a note on the Talmud, if you take a look in the Talmud today, you will find the Mishnah, you'll find the explanations and the elucidations of the Talmud in the same body of text. And then on the sides of our current publication, you have the words of the Rishonim, or what are known as the first ones, the rabbinic authorities that that were the scholarly leadership from 1000 CE until 1500 CE. You have their works that come and explain the words of the Talmud. When we'll talk in a little bit further about the Rishonim a little bit later, but among the most prominent Rishonim, the first ones, again, the scholars from 1000 to 1500, are Rashi, his students and descendants, who were the authors of the Tosafos, who are found on the page of the Talmud, Maimonides and Nachmanides, and we'll talk a bit about that more a little later on. Now, we have the century and a half about a century and a half that follows the completion of the Mishnah. It corresponds to a very impactful part of Jewish history. The Roman Empire adopts Christianity, the conversion of Constantine, the empire's conversion from paganism to Christianity. It will have a severe impact on the Jews. Eventually, the Roman Empire splits into two. The Western Empire would collapse in the 5th century, but the Eastern Empire would survive for another 1,000 years. Oh, Christianity becomes the official state religion of this new order, known as the Byzantine Empire. Now, the problem is with the disappearance of paganism, Judaism sticks out like a sore thumb. It's strange, it's separate, and it will not compromise. The stubborn Jews, as they had done with every other religion that had assaulted their belief system, they refused to bow to the new order. And within a short time, the Jews living in the Roman Empire or the Byzantine Empire had lost most of those civil rights. For example, if a Jew were to marry a Christian, he would be put to death. And the Jewish Supreme Court, the Sanhedrin, or the version that they had in the Roman Empire, was forbidden to meet at this point. And when the Byzantine Empire reclaimed Jerusalem in 629 CE, the Jews who found themselves there were brutally massacred. And at this point in time, things are looking very bad for the Jewish people. And the Jews, no doubt, could never have dreamed that relief would have come in the form of from the most unexpected place, from Saudi Arabia, from Mecca. A man by the name of Muhammad was preaching a very unusual message. By the time of Muhammad's death in 632, Saudi Arabia was united, that area was united, and poised for jihad, for holy war, to bring the world under Allah. Under their God. Shortly, it moved with a fearsome power against the Byzantine and Persian empires. So the Muslim armies started to move against the Byzantine and Persian empires, and this meant something very important for the Jews. Many Jewish historians are convinced that the Byzantine church would have attempted to eradicate Judaism completely if the church itself had not been defeated and its plan for domination in Asia Minor and the Mediterranean basin would not have been thwarted by the rising tide of Islam. So the coming of Islam may be seen as a providential occurrence in many ways that allowed the Jews to almost slip between the cracks that Islam had made in the Byzantine church's persecution. As part of the Muslim conquests, Caliph Omar, he invades Jerusalem in 638, taking it over from the Byzantines. He finds the Temple Mount in ruins and covered with garbage because the Byzantine Empire had deliberately decreed that garbage should be dumped there to humiliate the Jews. In 691, about 50 years after Omar's conquest, an Umayyad ruler named Abd al-Malik, he builds the Dome of the Rock there. He builds the Dome of the Rock there, that golden shrine that we see when we visit the Western Wall in Jerusalem today. It still stands today, as I said, and it dominates the Jerusalem skyline. So that's where we're holding now. 691, Muslim rulership has dominion over Jerusalem, has dominion over Israel, and it's almost providential. Their emerging is almost providential for the Jewish people. Now, at this time, I just want to give one moment of discussion on Babylonia. During the Second Temple period and up until its destruction in 70 CE, the Jewish community in Babylonia, far from the eye of the storm that raged in Israel, it continued to flourish. This is really where the center of Jewish rabbinic authority came to rest after the Roman Empire shut down the Sanhedrin in 363, the Supreme Jewish Court in 363. Now, part of the reason for the stability of the Jewish community in Babylonia was that the area was held by the Persian Sassanian dynasty, from the 3rd century CE and on. this Persian, the Sassanians, they managed to keep out of their kingdom first the Romans and then the Byzantines, which meant that the Jews of Babylonia were protected from the harm that the Byzantine Christians had inflicted on Jews everywhere else. And it's in this atmosphere that Jewish scholarship was able to flourish, in the great yeshivas, the great Jewish academies at Sura and Naharda, which later moved to Pumbedisa. The rabbis, as we explained a little bit earlier, they were these rabbis in Babylonia, the early ones from 200 to 500 were known as the Amoraim. They were the ones, as I said, were the scholars, were the rabbis that are whose lessons and teachings are brought in the Talmud. They were followed by the Gaonim, which is Hebrew for the geniuses. They were the heads of the yeshivas at the time when Jewish scholarship thrived in Babylonia. But then the situation changed. Things did begin to worsen for the Jewish Babylonian community in the middle of the 5th century, when Persian rulership, fighting against Christian missionaries, unleashed anti-Christian persecutions, and as would often happen, Jews found themselves in the crossfire. Things went from bad to worse. One of the Reish Galusas, one of the heads of the Jewish communities of Babylonia, were executed at one point. Now, what's important to point out, it's that in the midst of this chaos, the Muslim conquest, and as things start to look worse and worse for the Jewish people of Babylonia, as I said earlier, the Muslim conquest actually brought unexpected benefits to the Jewish community in Babylonia as well. So it wasn't just for the Jews of the Roman Empire, but also for the Jews of Babylonia as well. And in fact, when Caliph Omar defeated the Persians and took over Babylonia, he immediately reinstituted the authority of the Reish Galusa, the head of the Babylonian Jewish community, to the Jewish community. Going back, speaking about the time of the Gaonim, the great scholars of Babylonia, when Sadia Gaon died in 942, that was basically the end of the period of the Gaonim of Babylonia. It would end in 1038 with the death of Chai Gaon or Hai Gaon. By then, a great many Jews had left Babylonia, not necessarily because of persecution, because things did improve in Babylonia, but other opportunities were opening up for them in other parts of the world that were conquered by the Muslims, specifically in Spain. And that's where we're going to go to now. Things were so good for the Jews there for so long that half of the Jewish world is known as the Sephardim, or as the Spanish Jews. Of course, the other half, or not exactly half, because there are other types of Jews as well, but another big portion of the Jews, they're referred to as Ashkenazim, which means German. And things in Spain were amazing for the Jewish people, but then they ended abruptly when a Muslim Berber dynasty, the Almohads, they came to power in the 12th century. They seized southern Spain, and they gave the Jews three choices: convert to Islam, leave, or die. Of the many Jews fleeing Spain at this time, one was none other than Maimonides, often known as the Rambam, which is the acronym of his full name, Rabbi Moshe, the son of Maimon. Maimonides refused to make money, was one of the most important scholars in Jewish history. He refused to make money from his Torah knowledge, so therefore, he also became a physician. And within a short time, he was so famous as a physician that he was appointed the chief physician to the court of Sultan Saladin in Cairo. He was also appointed the chief rabbi of Cairo at the same time. Not too bad. In addition to being a famous doctor and a healer, he was a prolific writer. His works are universally accepted and revered. He is known in the Jewish world, as I said, as one of the most important scholars in our history. In addition to Maimonides, you have some other very important Rishonim, which was a word that I mentioned earlier. Those were the first ones, the scholars between 1000 and 1500. Some of the other most famous Rishonim were Rashi, which is an acronym for his name, Rabbi Shlomo, the son of Yitzchak, and of course Nachmanides, the great Jewish philosopher as well. We don't really have time to discuss the many great rabbinic personalities who lived at this time. What's interesting to point out is that even though this was one of the most difficult periods of time in Jewish history, The 400 or 500 year period of the Rishonim was one of the greatest periods of Torah scholarship. Their impact was monumental, and they played a pivotal role in transmitting the Torah and shaping the law and practice of diaspora Judaism. Now, let's go to take a look at a church-dominated Europe around the year 1000. As their empire grows, as the church's empire grows, so did its need for money to support it. And hence the Crusades. Now, of course, the Crusades were in part launched to curb the growth of the Muslim empire, but another important motivation was money and land to support their growing population. But the reason given at the time was the reclaiming of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem from the Muslims and saving the Eastern Christian Empire of Byzantium from the Turks. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, of course, is the site where Jesus was buried following his crucifixion. You can visit that church till this very day in Jerusalem. Just by the way, of course, Protestant Christians disagree. They do not believe that is the site of Jesus' burial. The Crusades, though, turned into campaigns of slaughter, rape, and pillage to the Jewish community as well of Europe. It was almost as if, why would we bother with the infidels? Or, you know, before we get to the infidels outside of Europe, let's get to the infidels inside of Europe and let's kill all the Jews. And that's kind of what the Crusades marked. It was the first large-scale European mob violence directed against Jews, which becomes a pattern for the next many hundred years. Of course, you'll have the pogroms a little bit later on. There were altogether 10 Crusades covering a period of time between the 11th and 13th century. The first Crusade, 1095 to 1099, that saw the taking of Jerusalem from the Muslims, the slaughter of both the Muslim and Jewish populations of the city, and the establishment of a Crusader-run Latin kingdom of Jerusalem, but even it did not last long. It only lasted until 1187. The second Crusade was 1147 to 1149. It is the Crusades that are responsible for the decimation of 30 to 50% of the Jewish community of Europe. It's the beginning of an excruciating period of time in Jewish history. Constant and unrelenting Christian persecution. You have the Jews expelled from England, France, Hungary, Germany, Austria, Lithuania, Spain, and Portugal. You have, this is the period of time when Jews become the money lenders, not out of any fault of their own. You have Jew taxes. You have the blood libel, the concept of the blood libel. You have massacres of Jews in many European communities. So, for instance, you have in 1348, the Jews of Strasbourg were burned alive, but that was just one example. This was also the time, as part of the general physical and economic isolation of the Jews throughout the 11th to 16th centuries, there were special areas for Jews to live, and these were called ghettos, which is the name of Italian origin. The Italian word ghetto means ironworks, and it refers to a place where metal was smelted, which is its foul, foul smell. In other words, it's the perfect place for the Jews. Now, it was first used as a place for the Jews, ghetto, in Venice in 1516. The herding of Jews into areas specifically designated for them began several hundred years earlier. They were usually fenced off by a moat or a hedge to kind of designate its boundaries. The Jews were allowed out during the day, but at night they had to stay in. But the most terrible part is that whenever the masses got in their head that it was time to kill some Jews, which often happened right around Easter, they knew exactly where to find them. Then there was a way out of the ghetto. All you had to do was convert, but Jews didn't do that. As the Christian reconquest of the Muslim of Muslim-dominated territories, Jews in these newly reconquered Christian territories began to suffer from worse and worse persecutions. And now we get to the Inquisition. The Inquisition we're going to cover is the Spanish Inquisition, although there were many Inquisitions, which began by papal decree on November 1st, 1478. The marriage of Ferdinand V and Isabella I in 1469 unified Spain, which in some measure made the final victory over the Muslims possible. Prior to their reign, Spain was a collection of provinces. Now, united by marriage, it became a mighty kingdom. Isabella was a fervent Christian, and she asked the Pope for permission to set up an Inquisition to weed out heresy in the Christian world. The Pope agreed, and that was the 1478 edict. And then there was a royal decree on September 27th, 1480. The first inquisitors got to work a few months after the decree, but in 1943, that's when Torquemada, a Spanish Dominican monk, he was appointed as the Grand Inquisitor, and that's when the Inquisition got its bloody reputation. He was actually descended from Jewish converts to Christianity, and he outdid the worst anti-Semites with his brutality. The year 1492 marked the fall of Granada, the last Muslim stronghold on the Iberian Peninsula, and now Spain was a completely Christian country. And it was shortly thereafter they decided to throw all the Jews out of Spain. It was the day after the expulsion that Christopher Columbus left on his famed voyage of discovery. But that was the end of the Jewish settlement of Spain. And then Portugal followed shortly after. Now let's take a look. The period of history we want to look at now is known as the Renaissance. Which is from about 1350 to about 1650. Renaissance means rebirth, rebirth of knowledge. By the way, it's right around this time that the Ottoman Empire takes over the Middle East. And let's move our way to Poland now. Poland becomes Christian very late, only at the turn of the 11th century, and it's only then that it joins the European Community of Nations. And then it takes another couple of hundred years before Poland starts to emerge as a nation state with strong potential. And if you want to develop your country economically and culturally, what do you need? You need some Jews. So in 1264, the king of Poland granted a charter inviting the Jews there. It was an amazing document. It granted Jews unprecedented rights and privileges. They didn't immediately come, the Jews. Some did settle to test the waters. It was only when other countries started expelling Jews, England, as I said, being the first, that Poland became an attractive destination. In 1569, Poland unified with Lithuania, so their borders expanded. And what we know as Ukraine today became a vassal land of Poland. Another Polish king, he issued another invitation, this one in 1567. He also granted the Jews permission to open a yeshiva in Lublin at that point in time. In Poland, just so we're all understand, in the early 16th century, the Jews were allowed to have their own governing body called the Waad Arba Arzos. The Poles did not interfere with Jewish life and scholarship flourished. But then the Ukrainians decided to throw the Poles out of their land and a full-scale massacre of Jews began. 1635. That saw the first big explosion of violence in Ukraine against the Poles, against Polish people and the Jews. That attempt at revolution was crushed, but then 13 years later, 1648, this succeeded. It was the second rebellion, and it succeeded in freeing a large part of Ukraine from Polish rule. And it was led by a Ukrainian Cossack by the name of Bogdan Khmelnytsky. In large measure, it was directed at the Jews, one of the biggest anti-Semites in human history, on par with Hitler, especially proportionally in his genocide. His aim was genocide, and his forces murdered an estimated 100,000 Jews in the most brutal and horrendous way. So in 1648 to 1649, we know this as Tach Vitat, the massacres of Tach Vitat, which are the corresponding Hebrew years. The golden age of Polish Jewry came crashing down. But it's important to know that it continued to be the center of the Ashkenazi Jewish world still for many years. Okay, so now the Renaissance is coming to a close. Where are the Jews now? So half the Jewish population is located in the Middle East with a high concentration in Turkey and the lands of the Ottoman Empire. Half of the Jews are in Europe with a high high concentration in Eastern Europe or Poland, Ukraine, and Lithuania. Now, this is not to say that all the Jews lived there. Of course, Jews lived all over the world, including India and China. But for right now, that's how we should take a look at it. The Turks, as we've explained, they were traditionally good to the Jews. We saw how following the expulsion from... Oh, no, I did not say this yet. Following the expulsion from Spain, Jews were welcomed into Ottoman lands by the Sultan at the time, Sultan Bayezid II, with a declaration. They tell me that Ferdinand of Spain is a wise man, but he is a fool, for he takes his treasure and sends it all to me. Of course, referring to the Jews. As the Ottoman Empire spreads, the Turks come to Israel, and it was the greatest of the sultans, of the Ottoman sultans, Suleiman the Magnificent, who rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem. It's at this point that many Jews start to return to the land of Israel, specifically the city of Tzfat. In less than 100 years, the population of Tzfat grows from 300 families to 10,000 people, and Rabbi Yosef Karo, who lived from 1488 to 1575. He was among the Jews expelled from Spain, and he made his way through Europe and Turkey, ending up in Sfat. And it's there that he wrote one of the most important books in Judaism, the Shulchan Aruch, the prepared table, the code of Jewish law, which is followed to this day. He was a Sephardic rabbi. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, known as the Ramah, he was a Polish rabbi, the chief rabbi of Krakow. He wrote an Ashkenazic commentary to the Sephardic Shulchan Aruch. To this day, it is the Shulchan Aruch and the commentary of Rabbi Moshe Isserles, the Ramah, and its later commentaries that dictates Jewish law. Now, Rabbi Yosef Karo is most famous for his book of law, but he was also a mystic. And it's no coincidence then that he made his home in Sfat, because in his day, Sfat became the center of Jewish mysticism, also known as Kabbalah. You had the Ramak, Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, 1522 to 1570. He rationally systemized all of Kabbalistic thought up to his time, in particular the teachings of the focal work of Kabbalah, of Jewish mysticism, the Zohar. The most famous figure in the development of Kabbalah was Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, also known as the Ari, or the Lion. He lived from 1534 to 1572. He was born in Jerusalem, relocated to Tzfat. He arrived there on the day of the Ramak, Rabbi Moshe Cordovero's funeral. He only lived there 2 years, and he died at the age of 38. But in that short period of time, he revolutionized the study of Kabbalah. His teachings, which were recorded by his disciple, Rabbi Chaim Vital, they dictate the study of Kabbalah to this day. It was at this time that you had the so-called mystic by the name of Shabsai Tzvi. He became prominent. He was born in the early 1600s, and he became very well known throughout the world. Many people thought he was the Messiah, he was Mashiach, until that ended when he converted to Islam. As a result of what happened with him, there was a backlash that continued for many years after his death. The opponents of Shabsai Tzvi and his movement came out blaming Jewish mysticism for this fiasco. And now we enter with the Hasidic movement, the movement of the Hasidim, which translates as the pious ones. It was founded in the 18th century in Eastern Europe by Rabbi Yisrael ben Eliezer, Rabbi Yisrael the son of Eliezer, who became known as the Baal Shem Tov, which means the master of the good name. After the pogroms and the massacres of Eastern Europe, large parts of Eastern European Jewry had slipped into poverty. You had the physical destruction of Chamanelki, the 1648 and 1649, the tremendous disappointment of the false Messiah Shabsai Tzvi, and now you had a Jewish population of Eastern Europe, a massive Jewish population, almost in a state of deep depression. And Jewish scholarship became only for the elite, while the rest tried to eke out a meager living. Jewish religious life suffered, with the average Jew no longer connecting neither intellectually or spiritually with Judaism, with God, with the Torah. And this is what the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement, changed. His teachings brought about a movement which emphasized the idea of bringing God into all aspects of one's life through prayer, through singing, through learning on any level. He taught that even the deeds of the simplest Jew, if performed sincerely, were equal to those of the greatest scholars. Now, as the Hasidic movement spread, it did attract tremendous opposition at first from the more traditional and intellectually minded rabbis, but that has proven otherwise. As a result of the Hasidic contribution, Judaism became stronger and more ready to face the assault of a new secular movement in the Western world known as the Enlightenment. 1650 to 1850, the Enlightenment was a period of time characterized by breakthroughs in thinking, which steered the world away from religion towards humanism, individualism, rationalism, nationalism. This is Napoleon marches through Europe. He liberates the Jews from their ghettos. The idea of liberating the Jews and granting them civil rights, he pushed forward. And although he lost his war in the end and ends up in exile, what he put in motion, as far as the Jews are concerned, had a huge ripple effect. By the end of the 19th century, the notion of keeping Jews as non-citizens was no longer tenable in the very liberal environment of Europe. With time, Jews were granted citizenship in every country in Europe. Something interesting is that the last two countries to grant the Jews citizenship were Switzerland in 1874 and Spain in 1918. So by the late 19th century, Jews who had previously been physically and economically marginalized, who had been locked out of trade and professions, now were allowed into all areas of European society. It's at this moment of great change, that a group of German Jews formed what came to be known as the Reform Movement. In the early 1800s, this group of Jews, they wanted to maintain some kind of connection to Judaism, but at the same time, they wanted to be able to take advantage of all of the newly won rights and freedoms that were being offered to them. But that meant that they had to become full-fledged members of European society, which traditional Jewish lifestyles, such as keeping kosher and Shabbat observance, those would be barriers to that type of acculturation. So these German Jews set about dropping key aspects of traditional Judaism. The most dramatic of these was the belief that the Torah was given to the Jews by God at Mount Sinai. That made a massive difference. It's important to point out Moses Mendelssohn, who died in 1786, who was a brilliant intellect, who kind of became the, he advocated this, a quote-unquote rational approach to religion, and became almost the forefather of the Reform Movement. It was along the way that the Reform Movement coined a new term to describe those who stuck to traditional Judaism. They call them Orthodox. So that's where that came from. Now let's go to North America. Until 1820, the Jewish population of North America was only about 6,000 people. This changed, 6,000 Jews, sorry. This changed in the 1830s when Reform German Jews who had given up traditional Judaism, they began to arrive in the United States, in North America. Whereas the great migrations of the poor and oppressed Jews from Eastern Europe, who are more traditional, that would follow near the turn of the century. Because, just so we understand, this Enlightenment did not make it to Eastern Europe, where most Jews lived in the 18th and 19th century. The largest concentration of Jews, in fact, at the time, about 5 million, was still in Eastern Europe, representing 40% of the Jewish population worldwide. Let's just talk briefly about Eastern Europe, and then we'll go back to North America. From 1791 until 1915, the majority of Jews living in Eastern Europe were confined by the Tsars of Russia to an area known as the Pale of Settlement. This area, the borders, the Pale, consisted of 25 provinces that included Ukraine, Lithuania, parts of Poland. But the idea was that the Jews of Russia were specifically expelled from Moscow and St. Petersburg, and they had to live in the Pale. Later on, they were expelled from rural areas within the Pale and forced to live only in shtetls. Now, despite this oppression, some amazing things happened in the Pale. In 1803, you have Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, a student of the Vilna Gaon, the great Torah scholar. He revolutionized the concept of the yeshiva. The yeshiva, the Jewish academy, up until this point, they were small institutions supported by individual towns in which they were based. He founded a large institution for students from all across Europe, and it would be supported by many communities, and this was a model that continued. Although it was only in operation for less than 100 years, it became the model, the inspiration for the modern yeshiva, of which there are thousands and thousands and thousands of students learning in this day and age. Another major educational innovation of that period was the founding of the Beis Yaakov School school system for girls. Now, there was a lot of other types of persecution of Jews as well. Like in 1827, you had the Cantonist Decrees. These decrees called for the forced conscription of Jewish boys into the Russian army. They would be these boys between the ages of 12 and 18. They were forced to serve for 25 years, and every effort was made to convert them to Christianity. It was in 1903 that the Russian secret police began to circulate a forgery, which became the most famous anti-Semitic document in history, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which are the forged minutes of a secret meeting of world Jewish leaders, which took place every 100 years for the purpose of plotting how to manipulate and control the world in the next century. There were so many pogroms in Tsarist Russia that it would be simply impossible to list them. In one four-year period, there were 284 pogroms. In 1903, one of the most famous pogroms took place. That was in Kishinev on Easter. Now, as I said, we're going to talk about back to North America. Another thing that was happening in this period of time was emigration. We see mass emigration of Jews out of Russia. Between 1881 and 1914, 50,000 or more Jews left every year, to a total of 2.5 million Jews coming to North America. Now, although such a huge number of Russian Jews left, the Jewish population of Russia stayed pretty constant at about 5 million Jews due to the very high birth rate. Now, we might recall, when the Jews were exiled in their first exile from Israel by the Babylonians, it happened in two stages. First, they exiled 10,000 of the most prestigious Jews, which ended up being a blessing in disguise, because when the rest of the nation came to Babylonia, they found Jewish infrastructure in place. Synagogues and mikvahs and everything that was necessary was there. That's not what happened for the Jews of Russia. They came to America. They passed through the famous Ellis Island, and they found no Jewish infrastructure in place, because the Jews that had preceded them in the migration of the 1830s, about 280,000 German Jews, they resented the poorer Russian Jews, and they had completely dispensed of traditional Judaism. By 1850, there were about 17,000 Jews living in America. By 1880, there were 270,000. And the Jewish population of New York would quickly grow to 1.8 million Jews. The German Jews of New York, they built the largest Reform synagogue in the world. By 1880, there were about 200 synagogues in America. The majority of them were Reform, because, as I said, those were the Jews who were coming to America from Germany. In 1886, this is a very important point in Jewish history, more traditional Jews who were offended by the ideology of the Reform movement, they founded an alternative to Reform's Hebrew Union College. It was called the Jewish Theological Seminary, and it became the bastion of the new American-founded conservative movement. It's in 1894. So that's just a little bit about the about Judaism in North America, in its early stages in North America. And of course, there also were Orthodox Jews, but more Orthodox Jews didn't come till a little bit later. Now we have, let's fast forward to 1894. 1894, the famous case of Alfred Dreyfus, a captain in the French army who was falsely accused of spying. The actual spy was not a Jew. And even though that was discovered in 1986, the French army ignored and suppressed the evidence against the true spy, and they would not back away from its accusations. There were forgeries produced, and Dreyfus was tried and convicted of treason in a closed courtroom before a military tribunal. One of those covering this fiasco was a Hungarian Jewish journalist from Austria, Theodor Herzl. He was shocked that this could happen in a civilized France. He wrote in his diary about this. He wrote, "Where in France, in Republican, modern, civilized France, 100 years after the Declaration of the Rights of Man?" He was a secular Jew. He was assimilated Jew. But it made such a powerful impression on Herzl and brought him close to the realization that the only safe space for the Jews and the only answer to anti-Semitism was a land of their own, the land of Israel. He was not the founder of Zionism, but he quickly rose to the top and convened the first Zionist Congress in Switzerland in 1897, at which the World Zionist Organization was established. As this was all going on, you had Stalin. Stalin of Russia. He succeeded in purging all the Jews out of the communist government of Russia. The most famous of these was Trotsky, Leon Trotsky, most important Jew in the Russian Revolution, a leading organizer of the Red Army. He engineered the Bolshevik seizure of power in 1917 along with Lenin. And when Lenin died, he and Stalin were rivals for succession. He won, ousted Trotsky, and expelled him from the party, deported him from Russia. And this happened in 1929. As this was going on, it's about a couple years later, Hitler is putting into place his program to get rid of the Jews. In 1935, you have the Nuremberg Laws, the laws that canceled all the rights that Jews had won in Germany post-Enlightenment. And then you have the first explosion of major Nazi violence against the Jews, Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass, November 9th, 1938. 191 synagogues were destroyed and 91 Jews were killed, many beaten to death. And then, of course, this is the lead up to the Holocaust. 6 million Jews murdered between 1939 and 1945. Over 1 million children. This figure represents 69% of the entire Jewish population of Europe. Hundreds of communities, some of which were 1,000 years old, were completely obliterated. Eastern European Jewry had been virtually wiped out. Now, 1945, let's now turn to our homeland. Let's turn to the land of Israel. Before we discuss the Jews' return to their homeland, which is going to be the last part of this discussion, the last part of this class, let's just quickly review history. From the time that the Second Temple was destroyed by the Romans in 70, Jerusalem is leveled, the land of Israel is renamed Palestine, Philistina. Jews are barred from Jerusalem. The Byzantine Empire, which is the Christian version of the Roman Empire, continued this earlier policy. Jews are still no longer allowed into Jerusalem until the Muslims conquer Jerusalem from the Byzantines in 638. When they take over the land of Israel, they hold on to it. The Muslims hold on to it with brief exception of a brief exception during the period of the Crusades. The Turkish Ottoman Empire held on to power in Israel, in the land of Israel, the longest, 1518 to 1917. During this time, the Muslims generally treated the Holy Land not as a primary province. There wasn't much of an attempt to make Jerusalem an important capital city. Only a couple of the Muslim dynasties attempted to improve its infrastructure. Only limited building went on in the rest of the land. You know, obviously an exception is Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent, who did do some pretty amazing work. And by 1880, there were about 40,000 Jews living in the land of Israel and 400,000 Muslims. In 1882, an important organization was formed called BILU, which is an acronym for the words of a verse in Isaiah, Beit Yaakov lechu v'nelech, which means House of Jacob, come up, let us go. This came to be known as the first Aliyah, the first large migration of Jews from Russia and Romania to the land of Israel. Some 30,000 Jews came in two waves between 1882 and 1891. And they founded 28 new settlements in the land of Israel. The third Aliyah after World War I and the Russian Revolution brought another 35,000 Jews between 1919 and 1923. At this point, the dream of a Jewish homeland was no longer a dream. It was becoming a reality. As the Allied forces conquered the Ottoman Empire and the British took over control of the Middle East, when they took over the land of Israel, all of a sudden, a homeland for the Jews became a possibility. By this time, there were between 85,000 to 100,000 Jews living in the land of Israel, of a total population of 600,000. And then, of course, in 1917, you had a big boost from Earl Arthur Balfour, the Foreign Secretary of the British Commonwealth, who in 1917 promised British support for the cause of a Jewish homeland in the land of Israel. The Balfour Declaration, which was issued in the form of a letter to Lord Rothschild, November 2nd, 1917. Let me just read some of the words. His Majesty's government looks with favor upon the establishment in Palestine of a national homeland for the Jewish people. And it was 1 month later that the Turks surrendered Jerusalem to the British. Then you had a fourth Aliyah, bringing from between 1924 to 1928, bringing another 80,000 Jews to the land, a fifth, 1929 to 1939. bringing another 250,000 Jews to the land. And then you have on November 29th, 1947, the United Nations vote for the call for a vote for their partition plan. Of those voting, 33 nations vote yes for it, including the United States and Russia. 13, mostly Arab nations, vote no, and 11 nations abstain. As disappointed as the Jews were with the portion allotted for its Jewish state, they felt that something was better than nothing, but the Arabs rejected this resolution, and the very next day, the Arab rioting began. 2 weeks later, volunteers from surrounding Arab countries began to arrive into then Palestine to fight the Jews. On May 14, 1948, at 4 p.m., on the 5th of the Jewish month of Iyar, despite immense international pressure not to declare independence, Israel declared itself a state. After 2,000 years, the land of Israel was once more in the hands of the Jews. People danced in the streets, but not for long, because almost immediately five Arab countries declared war, and Egypt bombed Tel Aviv. The end of the War of Independence defined the borders of the new state of Israel in a radically new way. The borders were not the ones that the UN had defined and were voted on in their partition vote. In sum total, Israel got more land, though it lost the old city of Jerusalem. On June 5, 1967, Israel, realizing that the entire Arab world was about to attack, they launched a preemptive strike, a most brilliant preemptive strike in history. In one fell swoop, Israeli planes bombed the entire Egyptian Air Force, still sitting on the ground. A day later, did the same thing to the entire Jordanian Air Force. End up reconquering much territory of the land of Israel. And the old city of Jerusalem is once again in Jewish hands. And of course, the newly conquered territory becomes a source of tension until this very day. But the population of Israel continues to grow. Israel continues to thrive and is vibrant. The Jewish communities of North America thrive and they're vibrant. And of course, all over the world, there are Jews. There are so many things that happen after 1967. So perhaps we will end here for now when it comes to Jewish history in 2 hours. This is the end of part two. And I wish you all a good night and good health.